Welcome to episode 507. This episode is for people who experience recurring pain from injuries, from surgeries, from accidents, or for those that experience chronic unexplainable pain and includes things like fibromyalgia. Any of that stuff? Listen to this episode. Because in this conversation, I speak with a very scientifically minded chiropractor and functional medicine practitioner that wrote a book about why pain exists. And in this podcast, we talk about that along with why there might be some credence to the idea that it's all in your head. And no, we're not gaslighting you. It's brain, neurology, nervous system stuff. So listen and it will make sense. We also talk about why pain medications and opioids like benzos will never truly solve literally anyone's pain issues because they're not actually designed to be curative. And as all good things must come to an end, at the end, we land nicely at this place of exactly what you need to do to fix and eliminate your pain issues, and even lower the likelihood that your pain does not evolve into something like cancer or even worse. And it's so doable. This stuff is so doable. So listen, put it into action, get healthy. That's all. That's it. Okay, let's go. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Matty Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me. And now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? Before we get into it today, just a heads up that if you want to inquire about our real weight loss programs, the link to book a call is down in the caption or the show note down below. So scroll down, click the link, book in a time with myself, one of the team, have a conversation, and we'll see if we can help you or not. Okay, with me here to talk about pain today is Dr. Stephen Hussey, author of multiple books, but the most recent one relevant to this conversation is called Pain Sense. And this legend here was previously on episode 66 and 219 of this show, where we talked mostly about cholesterol and statin myths and the healthy or unhealthy heart. So both of those episodes, absolutely worth checking out. There's so much gold in there from Stephen. So if you're worried about cholesterol on any level, go and check those episodes out. But before you do, let's have this conversation. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. The previous episodes we did, like, people loved them, like, especially the cholesterol debunking and unpacking of, you know, the mainstream medical narrative. And I guess we do a lot of that on this show. But do you get much kickback from the stuff, the work that you do? Because you also spend a bit of time in this space of, like, unpacking conventional medical narratives.
Somewhat, yeah. Mainly just like snide comments on social media, you know, but occasionally I get the attention of, you know, some influencer who's got opposite views that I do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, usually it's just people on social media and they don't even have an argument though. Like they just say, oh, you're a chiropractor. Or, oh, you know, you don't read the research or whatever when I've cited everything. So it's, I mean, somewhat, but I just ignore it now. It's not a big deal.
I have a strategy with sort of haters or trolls. I invite every single one of them to have a conversation here on the podcast. Mm. And after 7 years and going through COVID, mind you, nobody said yes yet.
That's interesting. I like that. Yeah, that's definitely a way to call them out, you know? But yeah, if someone has like a relevant argument and wants to like have a discussion, I'm like, yeah, let's do it. But they usually don't.
Yeah. I would love to have more like legitimate, genuine debates or disagreements on the podcast. But I think people get a bit worried about like that I'm going to bring them in and like, you know, create all of these sound bites that publicly shame them or embarrass them or, you know, discredit them. Because I think one of the issues with social media is that we end up in our own echo chambers, our own silos of information. And like, and this is, you could even argue this is the problem with politics, is that no one's talking to each other. They're just repeating great stuff to other people that think that they're saying great stuff.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, on that point, just because we're going in that direction, I think that one of the most important things to recognize is that most people want the same things. They want a safe, equitable, happy life for themselves, their family, and everybody else. We just see different ways of getting there. And if we keep focusing on the differences rather than the thing that we want that's the same, we're going to tear each other apart. But if we focus on the thing we want the same and realize that there's a compromise or a path to get there that we can both be okay with, then that's what's going to lead us to the promised land, really. And so I would say focus on the similarities rather than the differences.
Yeah. The crazy thing is that, yeah, the carnivores and the vegans are all moving towards the same goal.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So what did you feel the need to get into this whole conversation about pain and write a book about it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a chiropractor, you know, for the past 13 years, I've worked in a chiropractic clinic. And so I'm treating pain. People come to me for pain, you know, and that's what they're coming to because they have low back pain, headaches, neck pain, that kind of thing. And so I just kind of got interested in it as far as like, because I have all this background information about health and physiology from a very different perspective. If people have heard my other, you know, episodes, you know, talking about heart disease. And so I just decided to kind of dig in a little bit deeper to pain, specifically chronic pain, but also why pain signals there in the first place. Why do we have pain? And then apply, you know, this biochemical, but also quantum or biophysics aspect or my viewpoints of how physiology actually works, which I think is contrary to what we are told or like, especially what we learn in medical schools and proper or like formal training and things like that, and apply that to pain. And so when I started doing that, I got a very clear picture of what pain is, why it's there, how pain can become chronic, and there's a few different ways that it can. It was enough for me to think, I could write this down. I could put this down and write it down in a book. And that also like writing things down also helps me conceptualize things and gives me my, confirms or, you know, my views on a subject is when I really think about it, and write it down. So that's what I did.
Yeah, cool. You said there's two ways that pain can become chronic. Firstly, what is the definition of chronic pain versus, you know, the alternative?
Yeah. I mean, so think about it this way. Pain is something that's very, very useful for us. We think of it as this bad thing. Like, I don't want to feel pain. You know, that's bad. But if you didn't have pain, you wouldn't live very long. If you didn't have a pain sense, you wouldn't live very long. And there's actually people who are, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately very intentionally, born without a pain signal or an ability to feel pain. And these people don't live very long. So basically, they never learn what creates pain to their body. So they never learn to avoid it in the future. And so that means they keep getting injured. They keep doing things that cause pain because they don't feel it. They keep injuring their body. They don't feel pain, but they keep injuring their body. They die from complications very early in life of injuries. And people will say, well, can someone just tell them what's bad for them? And just think about it this way. When your teenagers are growing up and you tell them, hey, don't do this, it's not going to work out, you know, that's not a good thing. How often do they listen? Sometimes they do, but most of the time someone has to experience something for themselves before they'll actually change. Right. And so it's the same with this. People are born without pain. We can't just tell them, hey, that's bad for you. That's bad for you, because there's no reinforcement, no very strong reinforcement of this is a painful thing. And that could be a physical pain or it could be an emotional pain. There's a reason we call like, I have pain in my heart right now, that type of thing. So anyways, that's the first distinction to make, is that pain is very, very important. So when you think about a pain signal, that is normal. It's supposed to happen and it's very critical for life. Now, when that pain signal becomes chronic, your brain's getting a pain signal from a certain tissue somewhere long term, that's not normal, right? So that's not supposed to happen. But if I like say, you know, bump into my desk or something, I'm like, oh, that hurt, you know, there's like, your body's learning, don't do that again, you know, be careful about that, that kind of thing. But if a pain signal turns on and it doesn't turn off, something has gone wrong. That's pathologic. And so that's what we're talking about here as far as like this pain epidemic that we're having with the opioid epidemic and all that stuff. We're talking about chronic pain. So technically, if I get a change in a tissue in my body somewhere, so a chemical change, which can be caused by many things. It can be caused by temperature, physical damage, changes in biochemistry within a cell or something like that. And those chemical changes can happen. And if it happens to a certain extent, that's a sensory signal. Like your body is sensing that and it's like, okay, something's wrong there. And it sends a signal to your brain. And the brain says, okay, something's wrong. We got to draw the person's awareness to that area. And the brain sends a signal back down to that area. And that's the pain. So that's why they say pain is in the brain, because pain is not happening. Like the signal for pain is not happening where the damage has happened or the chemical change has happened. It's happening here, and then the brain sends a pain signal down to pay attention to that area. So that's a sensory pain signal, right? Now, when that happens, the sensory centers of the brain, the sensory cortex, are communicating with the emotional centers of the brain. And so the emotional centers of the brain turn on when we have pain to give us this negative response to it. And that negative response to it is what teaches us to avoid it in the future. So it's usually a negative, oh, that hurt, I'm never going to do that again, or you're crying or whatever. It's this negative response that teaches you to avoid it in the future. And so that sensory pain signal, that's present in all life, animal life. But some animal life just has the ability to feel it and get away from it. But they never don't have the emotional centers to teach them to stay away from it in the future. And then vertebrate animals, all vertebrate animals have this ability to learn, have a negative emotion with it. So your dog, your cat, you know, those animals have an ability to learn that and avoid that pain in the future. And then there's a third aspect of pain, the cognitive aspects of pain. So the emotional centers are communicating with the prefrontal cortex, which is very developed in humans. And so humans are the only species that can literally think about the pain and wonder about its meaning and wonder about life in general, you know? And the cognitive aspects of pain apes may have some concept of this or some ability to do this, but not near as much as we can. And so it's important to know those things because chronic pain can be a chronic stimulation of a sensory pain signal. So let's say you've got an injury to your knee or something like that, or something's rubbing the wrong way, creating friction, you get a tendonitis and that's a chronic sensory signal. So that can be chronic pain from that until you correct the imbalance that's causing that in the tissue itself. However, if that signal's happening long enough and you're getting a chronic sensory pain signal long enough, it engages the emotional centers, it engages the cognitive centers of the brain. And now we're wiring all those things together, right? And if we're wiring the brain in that way, because the brain's very plastic. And if you wire those things in that way, now you can have a cognitive thought about a worry about pain or something like that. And it can engage the emotional centers, which engage the sensory centers. And now you're getting a pain signal back down to the body with no physical damage whatsoever. So there's studies that show that the extent to which someone worries about an injury and the pain they're in during an injury while it's healing dictates whether or not that pain can become chronic. Because when you're worrying about it, you're engaging the prefrontal cortex, then you're the emotional centers and the sensory centers, and you're wiring that system together. So then the tissue heals like in your knee or something like that. But you've wired it this way. Now the cognitive centers can literally turn on a pain signal with no physical damage happening whatsoever. So chronic pain can happen in two different ways. It can happen with a chronic sensory signal at first, or it can happen because you're cognitively turning it back on. Now there's a really interesting study, or I guess experience of one researcher back in World War II that illustrates this quite nicely. So we'll talk about that. So this guy's name was Henry Beecher, and he was an anesthesiologist. And in World War II, he was working as a medic, he was receiving, you know, soldiers with pretty gruesome, uncontrolled injuries off the front lines. And he was just asking them things. He was asking them how much pain they were in, like to rate their pain, you know. How much pain medication they wanted, and then also just kind of measuring their demeanor and their view of the pain and things like that. And then after the war, he was back at Harvard where he worked as an anesthesiologist, and he was doing the same thing with people coming out of surgery. He was asking them the same questions. And what he found was that the people coming out of surgery reported way more pain and wanted way more pain medication and had much more worry or discomfort about, you know, their situation than the people coming off the front lines who had much more uncontrolled and gruesome injuries. And basically when he was analyzing these people's kind of psyche and their viewpoint on the things, he came to the conclusion that the men coming off the front lines saw their injury and their pain as a good thing because they were leaving war and they were alive. And for some of them, depending on the extent of their injury, they weren't going back to war. And so they saw it as a good thing, and seeing it as a good thing allowed their cognition to activate or to deactivate the emotional centers and the sensory centers, and they weren't having as much pain, weren't requesting as much pain medication. But the people coming out of surgery, they didn't want to have surgery. And so it was just, they were worried about how it went, how is it going to affect their life going forward, all these things, right? Which is a very interesting way of looking at that and seeing and illustrating that the way we think about something has a huge impact on our physiology, but in this case, pain.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. About it makes me think of watching things like Vikings and medieval series, where like a battle wound or missing an arm or a hand is like a trophy. It's like a, like, you know, I've been to war. You know, it's like a sign of being like, I survived the battle. It's evidence that you know, you got through it. And it's such a different story to the one that I guess we have now in our, you know, bubble wrapped cotton wool wrapped lives of, you know, safety, and everything hurts and everything's painful. And so it's such a weird world that we're in now. Like, it almost seems like a huge deterioration of resilience. But I think one thing that sort of off the back of what you're saying is that some amputees can feel pain in a limb that is not even there.
Right. Yeah. So like, that's the perfect illustration that pain is in the brain, right? So pain is in the brain in two ways. One, if it's a sensory pain signal, that's coming from the brain to your tissues. But also, chronic pain, especially of a cognitive nature, is coming from the brain as well, because you're activating the cognitive center. So yes, if someone like an amputee has developed neurology in their brain, neurologically, to send a pain signal down to your knee, well, if the knee is gone because they've had that amputated, it doesn't matter. The brain doesn't know that it's gone. The brain is just sending that signal down, and you can feel pain there, even though it's not there anymore. You don't have that body part because pain is in the brain. They've actually done really interesting experiments where, like in the book, I talk a lot about how lots of times to treat chronic pain, you have to treat the body. You can't treat just the brain or rewire the brain. You have to treat the body to rewire the brain. And so how can you treat the body though, if something's been amputated, right? How can you treat that thing? And so they did these really interesting experiments where they used mirrors. So they mirrored the other leg that wasn't there, or the other body part that wasn't there, in a way that the person saw it as the leg that was missing was there. And so then they treated the leg in the mirror, so it looked like they were treating the leg that wasn't there, and they were able to rewire the brain enough that it stopped the phantom pain signal that they were getting without that leg there. So very interesting. It's all about tricking the brain into rewiring itself in a certain way. But sometimes you have to have the body part, you have to treat the body so that your brain can rewire itself in that way. And that's what they were able to do in those studies, those experiments.
That leads me to ask the question. So when we, as you're probably aware, but when we look into like the metaphysical impacts of disease, and you hear people that are meditation experts or energy experts or emotional experts, they often talk about the fact that different emotions, and Chinese medicine talks about this too, different emotions affect different organs in the body. And so I want to ask the reverse question in a way, which is like, we're talking about the pain or the tissue damage happens at the site. The brain is the thing that sends the information out to say there's pain there, we should respond to it. Does that mean cognitive and or emotional and or story driven pain that we sort of manifest ourselves by thinking things and feeling things? Does that mean there's truth to that idea that it's like that the brain will get an emotion or the story that elicits a certain emotion and therefore cause damage to a tissue or site that is otherwise undamaged physically?
Yeah. And this is the case, I think, when we get more like what medicine calls complex regional pain syndrome or fibromyalgia or things like this. So what's happening there is like you look at somebody and they don't have any physical damage or physical imbalance that could be creating a pain signal. At least you can't tell from looking at them or taking imaging or things like that. So how do we explain this pain they're having? And to me, if you look at these people, it's no coincidence that, you know, up to 75% of people with chronic pain also have mental health disorders or past trauma or things like that. So basically what's happened is they've unfortunately had this life that's exposed them to a lot of experiences that lead them into this chronic worry or angst or fear or things like that, which trauma can do, or even like, you know, blaming or feeling that something's your fault, which is lots of people with trauma feel that way, that the trauma was their fault, even if it wasn't. And that type of mental state for a long time, rewires the cognitive centers of the brain to the emotional ones. And that eventually touches the sensory ones and the sensory cortex. And now you're sending pain signals down to the body with no physical damage whatsoever. They may not even have had like past trauma, physical trauma. You know, this is more emotional at this point. I mean, it's all due to the way their brains have been programmed to deal with those situations, those emotions, right? And now it's causing pain. And those are the people that it's very hard to get on top of their chronic pain and get rid of it. So that's the thing, is that this leads me right into like the approach of Western medicine and how it's never going to work, right? Because if you've got something like a cognitive aspect of pain, where these people have had these traumas and they've wired their brain in a certain way, and you give them an opioid, which is designed to shut down sensory pain pathways, which, first of all, there's multiple sensory pain pathways. If you give one opioid that shuts down one of those pathways, doesn't mean that all get shut down, right? And so that doesn't work very well unless you make it strong enough that it literally inebriates them. Someone who has a chronic cognitive pain signal, how do you turn that cognition off? You inebriate them, right? Yeah. And then it works, right? Yeah. You get drunk, you get high, and it goes away temporarily, right? And this is, and I'll never forget the day that, you know, a patient walked into my clinic and he was just like, I was like, yeah, so what brings you here? And he was just like, I'm looking for different pain solutions. You know, he's like, I used to be addicted to opioids and my whole family's addicted to opioids and I got off them and I'm trying to help other people now. And he's like, they don't work. They just mess you up enough to where you can't feel the pain. And then it comes back later. And I was like, he doesn't even need to know the stuff that I know about all the neurology. He understands that that's how it works. And so that's why they're so addictive, right? Because they have to make them strong enough that it literally inebriates you so you don't feel pain. So it worked temporarily. You don't feel pain, but then it wears off and you're right back to that pain. So you're back in that pain state where you're just like, oh, well, it didn't work. I'm in pain again. Or you're right back to the life that you don't enjoy because of your pain. And so how do you get back to that state of euphoria? Use again, right? And that's what addiction is. Addiction is not so much in that the substance you're using has this crazy biochemical effect on your brain that just makes you addicted to it. There's this large, a very large component of you don't enjoy your life, or the symptom you're trying to fix with the substance you're using just comes right back. And then when that happens, it just makes things worse and makes things worse and makes things worse. And you just keep using. And then people find harder and harder drugs. And that's how addiction happens. So there's like, if you talk to people who work with people with addiction, like a huge aspect of getting over addiction is not just, refraining from the thing. They have to do other things that rewire their brain. So they have to have a social support system. They have to exercise. They have to, there's a million things that we rewire your brain, circadian rhythm or proper diet, like all these different things. Like those are huge aspects of getting over addiction, because you've got to rewire the brain to where you're not getting that cognitive pain signal still. So, yeah.
Stephen, nobody wants to do the lifestyle stuff. What are you talking about, man?
Well, I'm just here to tell you.
No, I know.
Success, there it is.
Yeah, totally. It's funny because so many of these conversations end up back at the same place, as you know, which is like diet, get the sun into your skin and in your eyes, and drink clean water and all of those things. And it's just it's wild that we're still kind of banging on this drum to convince people, like the stuff that got us here of thousands and thousands of years of evolution, it still works.
Yeah, I mean it makes the most sense. And so that's just how I've had to learn things. It's like, why does setting your circadian rhythm make sense for health? Why does drinking clean water make sense for your health? Why does avoiding toxins? Because for, the millions of years that even the species before modern humans came about, like that's the environment that was in. So all of this physiology is catered to that. And in the last, especially in the last 250 years or so, there's been some massive changes that have happened. And humans are incredible at adapting and still staying alive. It doesn't mean we're going to be happy and healthy, right? You look at, chronic disease, basically that's an adaptation to this environment that we've changed so drastically. And how has it changed? Well, we went from living like literally outside in infrared light, like in sync with the sun, in contact with the earth, eating natural food, clean water, movement all day long, to not doing any of those things. Living indoors, away from infrared and sunlight, artificial light disrupting our circadian rhythm, tons of toxin exposures, processed foods diets that aren't nutrient dense, traumas, stored traumas, all those different things have all drastically changed this environment. And it's just like, in the face of all that, the fact that humans can still be alive and even reproduce, like in the face of all that is crazy at our ability to adapt, but it doesn't lead to a life of happiness and longevity and not being, or being healthy. It creates this life of struggle and sickness, you know, and that's the issue that we're creating. So yeah.
I'm curious on a more physical level. So actually, I'm going to ask you this question first. So does that mean chronic pain is mostly psychological? Because you're listening here, I can safely assume you're an absolute legend. And so if you want to keep this party going, I'd love to invite you over to follow me on Instagram or YouTube, both under the same name of The Real Weight Loss Coach. Over there, you'll find different content in both places. It's different. So heaps of bite-sized pieces of information. So if you want to learn lots of things really fast with a bit of a scroll, or simply you just prefer some visuals, then scroll over to The Real Weight Loss Coach on Instagram and YouTube. So see you there. Thank you. And let's get back into the episode.
In a lot of cases, yes. Whether you've gotten an injury before and you had pain from that injury, or you've got some sort of imbalance, it's like wearing your knee the wrong way or whatever, you know, or wearing your shoulder the wrong way or some past injury that's done that, and you get this chronic sensory pain signal, that could be a source of chronic pain. Now, whether or not that becomes, like, if you fix that imbalance, that's great. But if while you were dealing with that chronic pain, you worried about it so much that it wired the cognitive centers of your brain to the emotional centers and to the sensory centers, you could fix that imbalance and you could still get pain from a cognitive aspect, right? Mm. So it just depends. Like when someone says I have chronic pain, I got to figure out where it's coming from. Is this more cognitive or is this more chronic sensory, right? Mm-hmm. Because there, so here's an example. Like, there's a study, there's lots of studies like this actually, where they took people without any sort of pain and they just did some sort of imaging. Like they did this one, they did MRIs of their low back. And in 52% of those people, there was severe, not just some degeneration, but severe degeneration in their lumbar spine, but they had no pain whatsoever in their lumbar spine, right?
Yeah, right.
And then 50% of people, you know, the other 48%, I guess, had no degeneration and they also didn't have pain. So it goes to show that, you know, that degeneration, that imbalance right there doesn't mean it has to have pain. It's all about the biochemical state, which I would say is all about body charge and having enough voltage in the tissue, because that's the chemical change we're talking about. You could call that inflammation. You could call it oxidative stress. You can call it pH, you know, acidity versus alkalinity, all that kind of stuff. We're all describing the same thing in a tissue. So in that sense, like, these people could be having a chronic pain signal because of that tissue change, but they're not, right? And so it's kind of this fine line. It's like you can't say that it's all one or the other. It's all cognitive or it's all sensory. We have to figure out which one it is, depending on where that person is in their timeline of pain. But I also know that if I interview somebody and ask them what's going on, like, oh, I have chronic pain. Oh, well, tell me about what's happened to you in your life. And they start listing off all these traumas or this really tough life. I'm like, okay, this is probably more cognitive, right? They've, even if they've never had these, an injury happening right now or some major imbalance or an injury in the past that's created scar tissue or things like that, even if they've never had that, they could still have chronic pain just from the rewiring of their brain due to all these emotional traumas and the cognition that's created, that's wiring those centers together. So, so I would say that not all chronic pain is cognitive, but I think a large majority of it is. And that's where I think medicine's getting it wrong, is they're assuming that chronic pain has to do with the spot that someone's feeling pain. And it has to do with the brain and rewiring the brain, which, again, there are many, many ways we can rewire the brain. But it all comes back to the same stuff that I'm sure is reiterated a lot on your podcast.
Well, I was just going to say, like, does that mean we're booking in with psychotherapists, hypnotherapists, you know, doing that kind of work? Is that where people would need to go in conjunction with maybe the structural tissue support that they need as well?
Well, so if there is like a lot of past trauma and things that or emotional dysregulation or things like that, then yes, psychotherapy, hypnosis, all those different things can be things that are useful or... But in reality, the goal of a therapeutic relationship is to create an empathic relationship that rewires the brain, that engages more right and left brain and makes them communicate to each other again. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the goal is there with that. And that's one thing that can work. But I would also argue that that's not, most of the time, that's not going to fully work on its own, because then the person can't just have that empathic relationship and start to rewire the brain and then go back to the environment that keeps it wired that way. So we need to change that environment. And so that could be, you know, family dynamics or relationships or things like that. But it could also be your light environment is incredibly off. You need to set your circadian rhythm, be very conscious of your exposure to blue light at what times. It could be that you need to start moving your body and rewiring your brain that way. It could be that you need to change your diet. It could be that you need to avoid toxins or get in contact with the earth and do things that stimulate this more balance the stress and non-stress response that your body is supposed to be having so that you bring that cognition and that worry down, right? So you stop worrying about something so much that it's wiring those centers. And you go to therapy and you're getting this empathic relationship, which is kind of rewiring things, but you're going to help that therapy work so much better if you go home and you do these things as well. But that can be a very, very important aspect of resolving chronic pain, because if there's a stored past trauma, or there's something that someone is not able to process, or energy that's stuck in their body that's not able to move, yes, that's going to keep you in this worry and incoherent state that's keeping your brain wired that way. So you got to resolve that. That's one thing that's important to look at for people.
And we're going to go into the physical before in regards to voltage and alkalinity and those kind of things. Yet maybe lean into that conversation a bit about the physicality of the tissue and what's going on in the body that I guess facilitates or dilutes or removes the pain.
Sure. Yeah. So when I talk about like a sensory pain signal, what's happening in a tissue somewhere in the body is we've had a chemical change, right? The chemical change. And what I mean by that is the voltage has changed. The voltage is not high enough. So there was this really interesting experiments done by a guy named Robert Becker. And he wrote the book, The Body Electric. And he was working on like regrowing limbs, like newts and salamanders do. He was like looking into why they do that. And if we could do that, you know, and he figured out that it's all voltage, is what triggers the limb of a salamander to regrow or the tail of a salamander to regrow. So he was just doing experiments and he would just measure, he was measuring the voltage of various body parts. And he found that the voltage, the areas of the body that were the most prone to voltage changes and kind of had the lowest overall voltage were the low back, the neck, and the back of the head. And it's just like, well, where do people get pain most commonly? Like low back, the neck, and the back of the head, right? So so those that suggested it's about voltage when we get this change in voltage. So we're electrical beings, right? And so what does that mean? So all life on the planet sustains itself by gaining energy to itself. And when you gain energy, you can use that energy to create order. And that's the order that we know of as health or proper physiology. If you don't have enough energy, you're going to, in the form of electrons, you're going to drop your voltage, right? So there's ways that we get energy from the environment. We get it from direct sunlight exposure. We get it from contact with the earth. We get it from gentle movement of the body. We can also harvest the chemical bonds from food and get energy that way. But all we're trying to do is take those electrons and use them to create enough charge in the body. That charge is stored in structured water, which I've talked about on the podcast when we talked about the heart and everything. So that structured water is what stores that voltage. And so when you hear people, you know, in the health space and they're talking about, oh, we have inflammation or we have high oxidative stress, these free radical molecules that are creating oxidative stress, or we have our tissue is acidic, right? It's not alkaline enough. All they're talking about, it's the same thing for all that stuff, is that there's a lack of voltage to the body, a lack of electrons, a low body charge, right? And so something is either we're not in the right environments that are creating that charge, or we're surrounding ourselves with things that are stealing the charge or making it hard for our body to maintain that charge. And so if we get an issue like that and we lose the charge, we can be in pain, be stiff and sore all the time. People wake up like that all the time. They're like, oh, I'm so stiff and sore, you know, because there's low voltage in your body. Or you could get physical damage to a tissue that when you damage it, it can't maintain its voltage. And what happens? That the body senses that chemical change that just happened, that drop in voltage. And we're just a big sensory organism is all we are. We're sensing our environment in many different ways. And we sense our internal environment too. And if that sensory signal says, oh, there's a drop in voltage there, the nervous system sends that signal up. The brain says, oh, there's a drop in voltage there. Pain signal back down. pay attention to this area. It's basically pay attention. This is something that could threaten your life. You know, fix this. And that's what it's telling us. So it's all based on voltage. It's all based on electrons stored in structured water. People think that ATP is the energy currency of the body, and ATP does hold an energy currency or energy bond of energy, but it's not the energy currency of the body. It has a specific role to do something with that energy. Structured water, which is this gel-like form of water in our bodies, that's what's holding the body's charge because it's a huge store of electrons. So if you put your body in a situation that allows it to gain electrons from your environment, you're going to build structured water because that's how it has to store. Your body has to store it that way. So yeah, that's conversation there about this chemical change that happens. So you can measure that. Like people say, it's more alkaline versus more acidic. You can measure the pH of something. And if it's more acidic, you've lost voltage. And if it's more alkaline, you've gained voltage. And that's what it's all about.
And can we simply just drink structured water, or must it be created in the body?
So it's kind of a semantics or terminology here. So like, I would say you can't drink structured water. People say, oh, I'm drinking structured water, or I'm structuring my water before I drink it. And technically you can't really do that. Well, because if you were drinking structured water, you'd be drinking like a gel. It'd be like Jello, you know, so you'd be kind of like trying to get Jello down. Because
is that a temperature dependent thing? Like at room temperature, it's a gel or?
Mm-hmm. No. So structured water is, water has the ability to hold energy. And so when it holds energy and it gets next to a water loving surface, a biological surface, all biological surfaces are water loving. It can rearrange itself, into what's called structured water, easy water, or exclusion zone water, or bound water. There's lots of different names for it, fourth phase water. And so what happens is, you know, we all know that water can be ice. It can also be water, liquid water, but there's this state in between the two that's more like a gel. And so it's different than ice because it's not just water molecules frozen together, stuck together. It's actually, they cleave off one of the hydrogens and it combines itself into a lattice-like structure that forms this gel-like substance. And most of the water in our bodies is in this gel-like state, which is why if I take the tissue in my forearm and do this, I feel like a gel, right? Mm. I don't feel like water, liquid water. I'm not a waterbed. I'm a gel mostly. that's what holds energy. So water holds energy. If it's energized enough and it's coherent enough, the water molecules are communicating enough to each other, then when it gets next to that biological surface, it will form structured water. And we see this in plant roots and trees outside. We see this in living things. We can do it artificially. If we take a hydrophilic surface like Nafion, which is it's a material we can use that's hydrophilic, put water next to it, and it will build structured water on it. And so this is happening in our body. And it all happens when you put energy to it, right? So the main form of energy for all life on the planet is sunlight, is infrared light from the sun. And so in Dr. Pollack's lab at University of Washington, they've shown that far infrared light energy, when you shine that on water, causes it to build more structured water. Because you're putting energy to it, it has to be stored somewhere. So it's stored as structured water on the lining of this hydrophilic surface that they build. And so that means that, yes, you can energize the water that you drink so that it's more coherent and it's full of energy so that when you drink it and it gets into your body, ideally, it will form more structured water when it gets in there. But you can also recognize that we are made up of water. We're like 99.9% water molecules by volume, right? There's lots of other stuff in there, but most of us is water. And so if you put your body in an environment that allows it to gain energy, you're going to build structured water that way. So this, again, means sunlight and being in contact with the earth. Those are the main ways that we should get energy. And then you can also harvest the chemical bonds from food and gain electrons from that and do metabolism. And those electrons are stored as structured water as well. We literally make metabolic water in our mitochondria during that process. So that's what it's all about, is making that structured water. So, and if you think about that as this fundamental purpose of life, of sustaining itself on this planet, is to gain energy and store it and use it to build structured water. You look at what humans have done, as far as you look at the statistics or the surveys or the studies, they show that the average person spends 93% of their time inside or in an enclosed vehicle these days. And so you're basically divorcing yourself from the sun and contact with the earth and you're not getting the energy you need. So of course it's hard for your body to sustain itself and create health if you don't have the energy. And then you're also adding in things that have been shown to steal the body's energy, like wireless signals and non-native EMF type things, as well as various toxin exposures. Like, we see these things, like these various toxins, as free radicals. They're oxidative molecules. What are they doing? Stealing electrons. They're stealing your body's charge. They're stealing your energy for themselves. And that's what we've done. What we're doing as a whole. And so that can create a chemical pain or a chemical change in a tissue that can cause pain, right? That's why people are waking up feeling stiff and sore and everything. It can make it more likely that some imbalance in your knee can cause pain, because now this friction is happening. If you got low voltage already, now you're going to get that chemical change that's enough to cause the pain signal in your brain. But just like those people who had the severe degeneration, they had this imbalance, this bone on bone thing in there. Why didn't they have pain? Because their voltage was fine, right? So the physical change that you see from a degeneration or an injury or something like that may not cause pain if your voltage is okay. And so that's what it's all about, is maintaining that voltage in the face of these imbalances that we may or may not have. So I know your question was about drinking structured water, but
no, that was good. I loved it.
It's more about getting toxin-free, mineral-rich, energized water and drinking that, so that when it gets into you and you get in the right environments, it can become structured water.
Yeah, it's wild to me how, I don't know how, what level conspiracy to go here, but like how much effort has been seemingly put into divorcing us, and that's a good word to use that you used before, from the ideas that putting your bare feet on the earth, you know, and putting your skin in the sun, they're two of the most natural, primitive, most important things to healthy human function. And it feels like unless you're a health professional and in a fringe group of health professionals and a biohacker, beyond that, it feels really, really hard to convince people to do it. And they might say, yeah, yeah, makes sense, and not do it at all and still go hunting for the supplements online or the drugs online or the support groups, you know. And it's I live in Australia, and the amount of effort that's been put into convincing people to stay away from the sun entirely, and now we have like the world's highest amount of melanoma as a result of, it's just wild. It's like, we are animals and that's nature, like we're made for each other. It continues to baffle me how convinced we are that it's just not important.
Yeah, well, the thing is that you look at the research on sunlight exposure, there's nothing there that shows that the sun is bad for us. Like, if you look at the studies where they use to say that UVB light causes skin cancer, they were done on mice and rats that have been genetically altered to have no hair, which is not the way mice and rats are supposed to be. So there's the caveat right there. And also, they take a UVB lamp and they just shine it on them, which is never the way UVB light comes from the sun. It's always balanced by all the colors and wavelengths of light from the sun. And they're taking this one isolated lamp, which is artificial, and shining on them, on these mice and rats that don't have the hair, and they're saying, yes, UVB light causes skin cancer, which makes no sense whatsoever. Now, you look at studies, and these are associational studies, so you have to take them with a grain of salt, the populations, there's studies in the UK and or in Europe and in the United States that show that the people who get the most UVB light have the least rates of skin cancer.
Yeah.
And people who get skin cancer, the ones who get more UVB light, once they have skin cancer, have less death rates of skin cancer. There's studies of people in the Navy that the people who work indoors have higher rates of skin cancer than the ones who work outdoors. And they get skin cancer more readily on areas that don't ever get sun or get less sun, like on their trunk, you know, underneath where your shirt would be, not on your head or your arms or anything. It's more common on the trunk. So what we're getting, the message we're getting here is that lack of sunlight is what's really causing melanoma. Now, does that mean that you just go out and get as much sun as you can without having to train your body or build up your solar callus? No, that's not what we're saying. But what we're saying here is that lack of sunlight is probably contributing to melanoma. And also blocking, like, the original forms of sunscreen just block UVB. And blocking UVB and letting in too much UVA has been shown to cause the changes in skin cells that cause skin cancer. And so they noticed that early on, and now they start making sunscreens that block UVA as well. But in reality, those aren't the things that are causing skin cancer. But if you block and create imbalanced light, that can. So the other thing is that modern windows filter out UVB but let in UVA. And so we're sitting behind these modern windows that are double paned or whatever, and we're letting in the wrong wavelengths of light, or the imbalanced wavelengths of light that's contributing to the changes in skin cells that cause skin cancer. And then you try and like go outside and you try and block them with chemical sunscreens, and you just add chemicals to the equation, which also can result in these changes as well. And I dug into cancer a little bit a while back, and I made a course on that, and cancer comes down to voltage as well. If your cells lose voltage, they can't maintain proper reproduction cycles. We start to get this rapidly dividing cell that's not getting a signal properly. It's getting a signal to rapidly divide rather than control division. But it all comes down to voltage. Again, health and all life comes down to gaining energy from your environment, maintaining your voltage so you can maintain the order that we call health. That's pretty much a basic understanding of it.
So the take-home message from this podcast is roll in the grass, get more sun, and do it naked.
That's right. I like it.
Man, I love it. I love it. I appreciate your time and all of your wisdom. Where can everybody that's listening that's like, Stephen is awesome, I would need more of him in my life, where can they go? Where are we sending them?
Yeah, my website is resourceyourhealth.com. So pretty much everything I'm doing is on there. I've just recently launched a heart health program. So people are interested in that. They can find that on the website. My books are on Amazon, but they're also on my website. And then I'm also on social media, just at Dr. Stephen Hussey, Dr. Stephen Hussey. People can find me there, reach out there.
Amazing. Thank you. I'll put those links down in the show notes below for everybody. So scroll down, click the link. And before we go, we're going to do this real talk segment. So I'm going to bust out a few questions for you to answer, and then we'll wrap it up. Sound good?
Cool.
Amazing. All right. Question number one. What's something that you believe now that made you laugh 10 years ago?
I think that I could possibly get rid of type 1 diabetes. I entertain that now when I didn't before. I haven't figured out how, what I would try or anything, but I'm kind of getting the sense that it could be possible.
What's one habit you'd be embarrassed to admit that you still have?
I don't know if it's a habit, but I still have a bit of a sweet tooth, I think. Even though because I'm type 1 diabetic and I don't have many carbohydrates, which I don't think everybody has to do, but I do that. It's still there. Yeah.
What's a rabbit hole topic you think more people should explore?
Structured water.
What's one supplement, habit, or wellness trend that you think is overhyped?
Just one? I'd say peptides. Yeah.
In 20 years from now, what do you want to be known for?
I want to change the conversation about heart disease and health in general.
And if everything you've ever said was deleted, what's one sentence you'd want to leave people with today?
It's not my sentence. It's somebody else's. It's stay curious, not judgmental.
Amazing. Well, thanks for doing that. And thanks for being here on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No worries. I'm looking forward to having you back.
Yeah, man. Anytime.
Thanks, mate. See you later.
See ya.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.